Welcome to Our Story, Your Story, the video podcast where we share our personal experiences and invite you to share yours. We are Toby Yunus and Shelley Carney, and together we'll take you on a journey through our lives and the lives of our family, friends, and guests. We believe that everyone has a story to tell, and we can all learn from each other's experiences. So whether you're looking for inspiration, entertainment, or simply a good story, you've come to the right place. Hello, and welcome to Our Story, Your Story. I'm Shelley Carney.
And I'm Toby Yunus. Thanks for joining us.
And tonight, we are talking about a journey of compromise and choices. And we'll get into the story of chapter 8. Chapter 8 from A Gypsy's Kiss. And that's called On the Roof, I believe it's called. Yeah. But we want to take a look at the picture first. This is Two Sisters Courtyard. It's a postcard that you will see talked about in this chapter. And it's a place in New Orleans. And there is some French that I don't speak French.
Oops.
Toby, would you like to take over on the French part?
Let me, what chapter are we?
Chapter 8. On the roof.
You want to tell people, while I'm doing this, you want to tell people why we're in two different locations?
Well, we are in two different locations because we're trying to stay safe because Toby got the Rona. Toby caught COVID on his trip to Spain, and wasn't bad enough that he had to leave me and go to Spain. All he brought back for me was the coronavirus. So, you know, how's that for a partnership there? What do you think?
I'm still working on the French.
Oh, okay.
For Andre, this was, let's see.
Well, why don't I get started while you're looking it over? What do you think?
Okay. Go ahead.
So again, this is On the Roof, Chapter 8. When I need to think about things, I climb the staircase to the roof from the second floor of our dormitory. I get up from my bed and toss Salinger on my pillow. It's February, and although the roof is protected from the wind by a 5-foot-tall wall, I'll need my jacket. I decide to bring Salinger with me. The night is crystal clear, and after just a few moments, I can count the stars and planets in the heavens above me. Leaning against the north wall, I can see the lights from Santa Fe's Plaza, and beyond that, Santa Fe High School, and beyond that, the buildings on Federal Circle, and then finally, the high desert's hills north of us. Breathing the fresh, cool air clears my head enough to start organizing my thoughts. I think about Dave and the conflict between doing what his family wants him to do and what he wants to do. I am reminded of my father, who went to college and then law school, hoping not only to become an attorney, but someday a politician. With his charisma and charm, which attracted the ladies and befriended the men of Taos, Santa Fe, and Albuquerque, he could easily have gotten elected governor of New Mexico. After graduating from law school, his father, my grandfather, suddenly died, and his mother asked him to give up his dream and take over the family business, a lumber trucking company and a car dealership in Taos. Being the good son that he was, he did as his mother had asked. Over the years, he grew the business in ways that eventually supported and created futures for all the members of the family. Is there a natural common conflict in life? The one between what you want to do with it versus what others expect you or need you or want you to do with it? To me, at this very moment, it feels that way. I know my family's plan for me. I will attend the University of New Mexico in a pre-law curriculum. I will spend my summers interning at law firms in Santa Fe with close ties to the family. I will attend UNM Law School, graduate, and return to Santa Fe to work for one of the named firms until I can afford to start my own. I will serve the needs of friends and family. I will marry a local girl, preferably of Spanish Catholic heritage, and we will have children that attend Catholic schools. We will build a nice adobe house in the hills above Santa Fe with a patio for family gatherings. We will take summer vacations by car because that's what people do. Someday I will run for office, probably for a seat on the bench. Are the happiest people those that have worked out a suitable compromise, a life that meets their needs and the expectations of the people around them? Sometimes in spring, my dad would come home early from work. He'd tell my mom he and I were going fishing, and in 5 minutes we'd be backing down the driveway in his fishing truck. On some occasions, we'd head east for the Pecos, and on others, north for the Rio Grande. On the way, we'd talk about rainbow and brown trout, fishing rods and fly lines, leaders, tippets, and the mystical attraction of his favorite dry fly, the Royal Coachman. He had his preferred spots on both rivers, and he'd find the one that was least busy with other fishermen. Once parked and out of the truck, he'd take a few minutes to rig up his rod and a smaller spin-casting rod for me, made by Zebco. Then he'd pull on his waders and walk into the center of the river with the assuredness of a man who knew precisely where he was going and what he was going to do. I would find a place along the bank and a log or rock upon which I could sit and cast and retrieve my artificial lure. But mostly, I just watched him. His effort was workmanlike in its persistence, but with a grace and confidence that had I known better, I would have envied. It was him doing what he wanted to do. No compromises. The trout limit was 12, but he would stop when he had caught 6, 2 for him and 1 each for the rest of us, except baby Paul, who had separate meals prepared for him. Sometimes I would catch 1 or 2, and after cleaning them, we'd put them in the freezer for a meal at another time. My dad found a way to enjoy a few things that were important to him. Am I ready to stand up for what I want? How can I possibly know when I have always had to live my life as dictated by my parents? I have to do something else, something for me. No compromise. The light from the street lamp overhead catches in the gilt title on the black cloth cover of Salinger's masterwork. I open it to see if raconteur Holden Caulfield has any answers for me. But before I can start reading, something falls from the inside back cover and onto the asphalt sheet of the roof. I bend over to pick it up and bring it into the light. It is a postcard of the Two Sisters courtyard in New Orleans. Turning it over, I find that it is addressed to Brother Andre. In a beautiful cursive hand, it reads.
Do you want it in French or the translation?
Whichever you prefer.
All right. I'll read the translation so I don't embarrass myself with my terrible French. It says, Brother Andre, we are very happy to hear of your visit before the Lenten season, meaning he would be there in time for Mardi Gras. And it's signed, with love, your sisters, Eliza and Margo.
The fates have spoken. New Orleans. But do I stop there? No compromise, says the wind. Merci, I whisper, to the heavens above. All right. So, Miguel is up on the roof, and he's trying to make a decision. This is his inflection point, where he's between the heavens and the roof of the school, and kind of trying to come to a decision. Do I do what I want, or do I do what my family expects me to do? Am I more like Dave, or am I going to be some kind of an adventurer who just runs off and does whatever he wants? So, that's kind of the story. What else can we get out of the story, do you think?
I think there's an element of the fact that he is between the heavens and earth. He's on the roof on a sparkling Santa Fe starry night. You know, it's clear skies. And he's consulting with the heavens in his own way, even though he's not a big heaven fan. But he's on top of the roof and communing with the heavens. and with his feet firmly planted on the earth via that the tar sheeting on the roof. And so I think that's his first recognition of the fact that in this space, the space between heaven and earth, each one of us represents ourselves to the best of our ability if we correctly decide to represent ourselves to the best of our ability. And so I found the moment very poignant in the sense that because of the position, because of his awareness of his location physically in that space, and because he used it as an opportunity to for self-realization and then self-actualization, actually a decision at the invitation of Brother Andre's sisters, looking forward to him to visiting New Orleans. And he took that missive, that little postcard on the front, the two sisters, painting of the two sisters' rooming house. They used it as a way to entice their brother, their blood brother, not just their brother in a Christian brother name, telling him that they were looking forward to visit. And Miguel interpreted that in a way that implied it was an invitation to him as well. We look forward to seeing you before the beginning of the Lenten season. They didn't say Mardi Gras. Before the beginning of the Lenten season, what everybody knows, the beginning of the Lenten season is Wednesday, Ash Wednesday, and the day before that is Fat Tuesday. So he borrowed someone else's reality, and in this place between heaven and earth, he made it his own. And by making it his own, he made that decision to move forward with his adventure. That's the moment where nothing was going to stop him at this point.
Yeah. And we take a trip back in time to a fishing trip or a series of fishing trips that mm-hmm. he took with his father. And he had that memory of he knew his dad had to do what his family expected of him, but then he was still able to carve out time where he could do what ever it was he wanted to do, because uh-huh. you know, that's kind of what we see as kids about adults. We're like, oh, they get to do whatever they want, they get uh-huh. to make all the choices, they get to tell people what to do. And then it's as we grow older and we start to understand that our parents didn't get to do everything they wanted to do, they uh-huh. had to do a lot of things that were expected of them as well. And yes, they told us how to behave, but that was because that was their job as a parent. So, you know, it was, they were beholden to the rest of society to raise children who were, you know, a good participant in society. They were good citizens. I think that was even more prevalent back in these times, in the 50s, 60s, 70s. So we're just kind of, the 70s, we were starting to break away from them. Mm-hmm. We're like rebelling. And I think in the late 60s, that kind of came around too. It was like the whole rock and roll thing. And there was that whole back and forth between, you know, am I rock and roll or am I going to listen to my parents? And again, it's that compromise of, you know, I can be a little bit rock and roll and I can also listen to my parents and I can try to do, you know, the tightrope walk and fit in with, you know, my family and fit in with my friends as well. So there's quite the balance of things in this chapter that are explored, the father-son relationship and the teenager to his parents, to his friends, to his own, you know, his own life and his own dreams. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot going on.
And you mentioned that, you know, my father and the seriousness of his efforts. My father mastered the art of role playing. When he needed to play the role of the CEO of a company, he played it perfectly. He was stern, but in a soft way, I never heard him raise his voice at his work, but I knew when he was being serious about something. He was playful when it meant going out with my mom, like, you know, places like the Baile de not Conquistadores, the Baile de Cascarones, where he was just the life of the party in a room of 250, 300 people, you know. He was, when he needed to be fatherly, he did a really good job of being a father, especially to my sister. He just adored her. And when he needed to play the role of a sportsman, a fisherman, he played it really well. I never can forget the intensity with which he fished for rainbow trout in the Pecos and Rio Grande River, with a perfect collection of flies tied perfectly to the perfect leader and tippet, and with a rod that suited, a bamboo rod no less, that suited him perfectly. And I used to worry for him because he didn't wear waders. He just had brown wingtip shoes, you know, and his jeans. He'd put on his jeans and he had this, plaid, red plaid jacket. And he'd step out into the water. And he had Polaroid glasses, the plastic frame, very inexpensive Polaroid glasses, so that he could see into the water. And I used to worry because I could see him as he was focused on hunting the fish. He would stumble or slip, and I always worried that somehow or the other he was going to end up in the water, and I was going to have to watch him, you know, flailing his way downstream in the Pecos or the Rio Grande. So he had that role playing thing mastered. He knew who he should be at any given point in time, and he excelled at that role at that point in time. And it's a good lesson for all of us because, you know, we're all blessed with opportunities, and we're all in those opportunities required to play a certain kind of role, from father to businessman to, you know, live streamer to storyteller, whatever it is. And I learned much from the manner in which he did that. And part of it is the price you pay. What was our friend's name that used to say, I'm Toby Unis, and I'm very serious?
Cherie.
When I go fishing, I go fishing. I don't go, I remember once going fishing with some, you know, planning a picnic and going fishing up on the Rio Grande. I said, are we going to do fishing? And I remember the young woman who I was with at the time being angry because I was out in the middle of the river playing the fisherman role and not back at the picnic area playing the boyfriend picnic role. So you have to be cautious, of course, because people will have expectations as to what role. And that was one thing, you know, I learned as I grew older, that you have to make sure that you're playing a role appropriate to what the people around you are expecting. You know, so when you're coaching a young girl's soccer team, for example, that's a role that doesn't involve angry faces or lots of loud noises. You have to be that calm, quiet, almost loving coach of a girls' soccer team. Otherwise, you're going to have them all in tears and reporting back to their parents that you're a jerk. So, but it was a good lesson for me. And I think I tried to capture it in this particular chapter. Although, mm-hmm. Like you said, there was a lot going on in terms of self-realization, self-actualization between heaven and earth. And the decision to move forward with his adventure.
Well, I think it underscores all of that, where you're talking about, you know, he was excelled in his role and he played the right role at the right time. I think that's got a lot to do with living in the present moment, living in this moment, not thinking about the future or regretting the past, but just being very focused on what's going on right then, in that moment, who's around you, and how they're all feeling, and what they're all doing, and, you know, what's going on right there and then. Mm-hmm. Not more about, like, how do I look, but how can I make this better? Mm-hmm. How can I bring my best self to this moment? And I think Miguel's starting to learn all of that at this point.
What amazed me about my father is that not only did he have the ability to play that role, and I'll use the example of the Baile de Cascarones again, where suddenly he's out there, people are asking him to go up on stage and play the clarinet in a you know, what do they call that band? The 40s, what's that period of that kind of band?
That's like the big band.
Big band, yeah. And of course, this was probably in the, I'm going to guess, the 50s. And it was on that night that I learned my father played the clarinet. I had no idea, you know, and he played it like Benny Goodman for all I could tell. And of course, he got lots of cheers. And then he came back to the table, and my mother, as she watched him, had this smile on her face of love and affection, like, that's my guy, you know. They were very much in love.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the point that I was trying to make is the next Monday he was back at the dealership, mm-hmm. doing the CEO role. And what was great about him is I knew Thursdays, because he had to work during the weekends, Thursdays was his day off. Like Thursday afternoons, he would take off and he would do different things. He'd go work in the used car lot just so he could keep his sales skills sharp. That would be the day we'd go fishing. That would be the day we'd go play poker. And I say, I was six. I didn't play poker, but I got to hang out with the guys that did. So Thursday afternoons was his, let me not be a CEO or a dad or anything else here. Let me just do this, you know. So I think he found that all a blessing for himself.
Yeah. And, you know, today, a lot of us forget that we need to have a Thursday afternoon for right. ourselves to do what it is that we really want to do.
Right.
If we don't have that, we build up resentment and we get burned out and we lose the joy in life. We get trapped in that, you know, rat race, and we just get like, why am I doing this? So we do need to take that time to do the things that we want to do. And Miguel talks about compromise. Dad had to compromise on, you know, his work. Mm-hmm. But when he went fishing, there was, you know, that was just for him. He didn't mm-hmm. have to compromise for that. What other compromises can you see that you experienced?
Well, for me, it began, of course, with his loss. That was the big compromise, the compromise of having to learn to live as a young man without your father. And so you start right away, you start getting into compromises, the compromise of you're not going to have a dad at your football game or your tennis match. You're not going to have a dad at your state debate championships, you know, things like that. So I think it was a good lesson in the art of compromise. Compromise doesn't necessarily, I love the way politicians used the word compromise before it became a bad word, right? Mm. Compromise was an agreement to agree. And mm-hmm. not everybody wins everything and not everybody loses everything. It's a compromise. And so if you can adopt the idea that occasionally you're going to have to make a compromise in life, it is less impactful on you personally than if you agree to the compromise. Meaning, if you recognize the compromise of the fact that your father's not going to be at all your football games anymore. Excuse me.
Time out.
A little dry throat there. If you accept that there's a compromise in not having your father appear at your football games anymore, then you look for a way to balance out the compromise that you've made by not having him there by waiting till the the folks, especially at Fort Marcy, come out of the stands and greet you, and you shake hands with parents who you don't actually know, but they congratulate you on the game, things like that, because there's always someone, especially at a football game or other sports events like that, who's willing to say good job. And that's all you need. That's the compromise. The compromise is you got the good job. It just didn't happen to be for your father. And so the loss of your father is an introduction to the art and value and benefit of learning to compromise. And it also means that you're never going to let yourself get in a position where the compromise includes the exclusivity of diminishing who you are as a person. Compromise doesn't diminish you. Compromise makes you a better person. Your willingness to compromise doesn't diminish you. It makes you a better person. And once you recognize that, compromise becomes a way, not necessarily of life, but a tool that you can use to move yourself forward. And one of the valuable lessons I learned is anytime I went into a meeting that required decision-making at the end of the meeting, I listened. I didn't say anything. I just spent the entire meeting as much as I could listening. And then when given the opportunity, Toby, do you have any thoughts on this? I expressed myself. And by that time, the expression of what my expression was a compromise of all the other good ideas in the room brought together in what seems like a logical or rational solution to the problem. And it's not yours. It's not your idea. And it's kind of neat to know that it's not necessarily your idea. It's simply the ability to find the good in everything else and use it to solve the problem and then have people say, oh, great idea. When half the people in the room are going, wait a minute, he took that from me, you know? And then as soon as you can, take the opportunity to go to the other people in the room from whom you borrowed those ideas and thank them for their ideas and tell them how much they contributed to the solution that we all agreed upon. Compromise has become, as a result of politics, a dirty word. A mature person doesn't see compromise as a dirty word. A mature person sees compromise as a way to get to a rational and logical solution to a problem. And that problem may be a personal one, it may be an emotional one, it may be a business one, but compromise shouldn't be treated as something that you're forced to do. Compromise is a way to get what you want while ensuring that the other stakeholders involved get what they want. And I don't know that he knew the sophistication of that at this age, but he certainly had an inclination that compromise would be better if you were part of the compromise rather than having other people make the compromise for you. Mm. And I think we're back to the conversation that we had last week where you can't make a life for yourself with other people managing their expectations for you.
Well, I was talking to somebody this past week about life and relationships, and he was telling me that his best friend is this person who has to have everything their way. Otherwise, they just kind of like fall apart. Mm-hmm. And we talked about how, you know, detachment from how things happen is helpful, because as long as you get to a good solution together, it doesn't matter how you get there. Mm-hmm. You need to detach your feelings from how things happen. They don't have to happen in a particular certain way at a particular certain time in order to turn out well. They can turn out well in the end, even, you know, if it seems crazy to you on mm-hmm. the way there. So I guess it's just a matter of not being too attached to your ideas of how things should be and being more open to other people's ideas and life experiences and how they can contribute. And I agree that teamwork is an amazing thing when it works well, when everybody's mm-hmm. Working together on a project and they all have the same end goal in mind mm-hmm. and they listen to each other and work together as a team, then it's so much more fun and fulfilling than if you just did it on your own and it was a lot of hard work.
So, and I think you said this in a very elegant way, actually, that compromise can only be successful for you and the individuals with whom are party to the compromise if you start by isolating your emotions from the process of developing the compromise. Because if you go, and again, part of what we have to deal with is the politics of compromise today, where you start with the emotions and you never give them up, mm-hmm. right? Until you get to the point. I was watching a documentary short on the three people that handled the discussions between Representative or House Leader McCarthy and President Biden. They weren't always actually in the room. They just had people who represented them dealing with what to do with the deficit, the combination of the deficit and the debt limit. And what I heard were these three people who, if you walked into a room, looked completely innocuous. It was a man and two women. And they weren't wearing flashy clothes and they weren't tall, you know, Wolf of Wall Street kind of people. They were just average. They looked like accountants. But almost everything that they said as they discussed the process sounded perfectly rational to me. And that's how they ended up with such a good deal. People said, Biden walked all over McCarthy, right? And McCarthy lost, Biden walked. That's not true. That's not how they saw it. They agreed upon a compromise that both men could sign off on. And that was the objective. Get that done and prevent the debt limit from being exceeded. And you can't help but believe these are people who don't bring their emotions to their table. They bring the goal to the table. Mm-hmm. And the goal is not to beat the other guy. The goal is to make sure you don't exceed the debt limit. What do we have to do to get to that point? And if you keep that bowl of rationality on the table, then it makes it progressively easier to get there. And unfortunately, our politics aren't always made that way. And because our politics aren't necessarily made that way, a lot of us have adopted compromise as wrong. I don't need to call it. I want it my way. I don't want to compromise. And until we get back to a point where people are willing to compromise in these situations, there's going to be a lot of turmoil. Mm-hmm. Because if everybody wants it their way, then nobody gets their way.
Yeah. Because nothing happens.
Right.
And
you don't move forward.
And the final objective is not reached.
That's right. You don't move forward. You don't make any progress. You just yell at each other at the top of your lungs and wave your respective flags.
So Miguel on the roof is deciding that he doesn't want to compromise anymore. He wants what he wants, mm-hmm. and he's going to go get it. Mm-hmm. So what do you think he was compromising on that he doesn't want to compromise on anymore?
Well, here's the funny part. He is compromising, right? Life is a series of compromises. While you eliminate one set of compromises in order to accomplish something that you want to accomplish, there's another set of compromises, right? But he had to compromise by having his mother send him to a boarding school in the same town in which his family lived. So the compromise was, I didn't have a choice. That was no compromise. I put up with it. That's the extent of my compromise, kind of like where we're at right now, right? Okay, mm-hmm. if that's what you want me to do, my compromise is I'll do it, right? But once he makes a decision to no more compromises, the simple fact of the matter is, like decisions and choices, life is all about compromises. And you just have to be selective as to which are in your benefit without hurting other people. It doesn't do me any good to compromise in my direction if it's not a zero-sum game, right? It doesn't do me any good to adopt a position that in which I gain something and somebody else loses something. That's the zero-sum game. I can only win it if I win it and you lose it, as opposed to I can only win it if you agree that you can win it too. And so if you look at the rest of the story, it's all what we've talked about in the recent past. Decisions, not right or wrong. Choices, not right or wrong. And compromises, not good or bad. And so I think he's taking these elements of life that are important to moving yourself forward and starting to put them together in a way that's useful to him. Now, he hasn't learned the lesson of the zero-sum game, because although he's going to have a heck of a good time, there's going to be a set of Christian brothers who are going to be worried about him. There's going to be some friends that will be worried about him. There will be his mother and brothers and sisters that will be worried about him. There will be some aunts and uncles, but there's no compromise there. He basically walked away and said, that's your problem. Right?
Yeah.
I'm happy. No more compromises. Mm-hmm. So he's about to learn the lesson of the value of compromise. And he comes back with it. That's the other, you know, we can't talk about the one. The end of the story is he learns all these lessons. He comes back wiser in the arts of decision-making, compromising, and choices, making choices. Yeah. And that's
the purpose of adventure.
Yeah, exactly. So that's what keeps him moving forward from that point in his life. And he applies a lot of those lessons that he picked up along the way, because not because they were forced upon him, but because he put the effort into making decisions, making choices, making compromises, and learned the value of the value of being good at that in life.
And I think you can't have a successful relationship if you don't know how to compromise.
I can't disagree with that. Right? I think that is absolutely right. Hold on.
So I think when we're in a relationship, what we want is we want what's best for the other person as much as we want what's best for us. And that is why it should be easy to compromise and say, yes, let's figure out a way that we're both happy, that we both win, that we both get what we want to some extent. And that is all based in love.
A relationship that's based on a zero-sum game is abusive. Whoever's the zero-sum game player. You can't have a healthy relationship without the expectation of some form of compromise that results in a solution that's equally beneficial and doesn't cause more suffering to one than it does the other. You might have to give up something, right? But you shouldn't have to give up any more than the other person. You may gain something, but you shouldn't gain any more than the other person in the relationship. And as long as you can manage that, and you use love as a basis, I think you also have to include communications. Because without the communications, the eye-to-eye, face-to-face, honest communications, I don't think you can get to that point. Yeah. But you're right. It's all in a foundation of love. If you're talking to each other without the energy of love between you, you're not going to make a lot of headway.
Yeah. I think those are very valid points, and I've got nothing to add.
And I thought I was over this thing, but I guess my throat is still dry from doing all this talking. I haven't done this much talking since the last time we did the show.
All right. Well, I think we're ready to close it up for the evening. Make sure that if you have not yet watched or listened to episodes 1 through 7 that you go back and get those episodes under your belt, because we are going to get really into the adventure from here on out. So it's good to have that basis for who this person is as we follow along with them on their adventure.
So do you feel like we've, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, do you feel like we've established a good foundation for what's about to happen?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. You know, the postcard comes out and he's like, oh, I'll be there. You know, I'm on my way. I'm Miguel. I want to be in Miguel. I want to be the adventurer. So I think it was just like, okay, we're ready. Okay. Mm-hmm. When are we, let's go. Yeah.
Yeah. The small elements of the Catcher in the Rye and the postcard from the Two Sisters Hotel. Mm-hmm. So it's a good part of the story.
Yeah.
Wonderful lessons to be learned.
All right. So join us again next week when we hit chapter 9. And if you have a story that you want to share about a compromise that you made and how it changed your life, we'd love to hear from you. And you can just write to us at stories@agkmedia.studio. And we'll share that on the air if you'd like, or if you don't want us to share it, just let us know and we won't share it. Anything else you want to add?
I'll look forward when we can spend time in the same studio together.
Yay. Maybe next week.
I hope so.
Okay. Thanks for joining us tonight, and we'll see you next time. Thanks for listening to Our Story, Your Story. We hope you enjoyed hearing our stories and those of our guests. We invite you to share your own stories with us by emailing us at stories@agkmedia.studio. And don't forget to subscribe to our podcast so you don't miss any future episodes. Until next time, keep telling your story, because your story matters.